p.m. on the second Tuesday of every month, Dennis and I will cover the news, issues, and events here on the campus of HFCC and talk about how they relate to the surrounding communities.
Basically, we bring you all the news we think you want to know about our college and our station, WHFR.
We talk about the fantastic restaurant we have right here on campus.
And upcoming performances of HFCC plays and musicals.
We'll even keep you posted on the success of our various sports teams.
In fact, we fill you in on all of the campus activities open to the public, many of them absolutely free.
So when it comes to Henry Ford Community College news,
make the connection.
The HFCC Campus Connection. On 89.3 FM from 1 to 2 p.m. on the second Tuesday of every month.
That's WHFR.FM.
The station making waves.
Hi, this is The Shyster, the host of the Sunday Blues Review Show. I invite you to join me each and every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. while I do my part to keep the blues alive in a Motor City. On the only station making waves, 89.3 WHFR.
Impact is a public affairs talk program taking an in-depth look at specific nonprofit organizations, events, and people who have taken up a cause to make a positive change in our communities and around the world. This show has been pre-recorded. Welcome to Impact. This is 89.3 WHFR.FM. I am your host, Kristen, and today we will be talking about watersheds and why they're important, especially watersheds here in Southeast Michigan. And today I have with me Dr. Oren Gelderloos, who is Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at U of M Dearborn. Thank you, Mr. Gelderloos, for being here. Greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's nice to be here.
Could you just give us a little bit of a background about your profession and what you do?
Well, I teach at the University of Michigan Dearborn, and I teach biology, and that was my first love and the area that I went into originally when I got my doctorate. It was an area of environmental physiology, but at the same time that I came to U of M Dearborn in 1969, we were heading up to the first Earth Day on April 22, 1970. And I was the only faculty member on the campus that was able to be involved in that at that time. And that took in a great deal of social action, took in community involvement. We had to be a very interdisciplinary group to take into account the business people and the economic people and the ethics people and all things like that. And so then I developed the environmental science and the environmental studies program at the University of Michigan.
So you have a lot. You had a lot to do with the startup then of the Environmental Interpretive Center that's over there.
That's correct. At the same time, we had this wonderful resource, which is a natural area, which is part of the Henry Ford Estate originally.
Beautiful.
And at that time, I said, well, everybody should be involved in this. And so on that Earth Day, we had our first public tours in which I posted some numbers on signs around the area with an interpretive guide for people to read as they went and walked through the area. And that was the beginning of it. I'm grateful to my predecessors there, however, Dr. Cal DeWitt and Dr. Emmanuel Hertzler, for preserving the area and keeping it from having the road of Hines Drive connect Ford Road to Michigan Avenue. That there were plans for it, and there probably still are plans around us in a drawer somewhere.
But as long as you're around, it's not going to happen.
That's right. That's right. But since that time, we've had some very nice things happen, and that is that Wayne County has had a contract with the university that we will be the stewards of the floodplain area that Wayne is owned and operated by or under the control of Wayne County. In return, we will educate the citizens of Wayne County and Southeast Michigan and anybody else through the Interpretive Center, which Wayne County supported with funds, partially funding the Interpretive Center so that we can educate the general public. And we do this by having tens of thousands of school children and citizens come to the campus every year for study programs. And it's open 7 days a week, sunrise to sunset. And so that's a very important gateway to the floodplain community and the natural area of the former Henry Ford Estate.
And speaking of the floodplain area and the natural area back there, one of the major things that runs through the Nature Center area back there is the Rouge River.
Absolutely.
Which is one of the major watersheds that are here in the Metro Detroit area. I was on EPA.gov, and it said it is the most densely populated and urbanized land area in the state, and that it empties into the Detroit River, which connects Lakes St. Clair and Lake Erie. So it is a very important watershed area back there.
Oh, definitely. It's highly populated, and it is the most densely populated. We have 1.5 million people living in the watershed. And when you think of the fact that it's a small watershed by watershed standards, like the Mississippi or the Missouri or even the Grand River and the Muskegon River in the state of Michigan, we have a watershed which goes from Oakland County into and Washtenaw County and Wayne County. And it covers a fair amount of area, but it's a watershed we can get our arms around and we can understand it. And despite the fact that we have 47 different communities and governmental units involved in it, we can still get these people together, and they are working together. And this is the beauty of a watershed project and a watershed program.
Just to be clear, what, for I guess layman's terms, what is a watershed?
It's an area of land, first of all, an area of land from which water drains when it comes down as rain or snow or hail or sleet, whatever, and the water has to go somewhere. And so, first of all, it can go into the ground, or it can stay on the ground and evaporate. If it goes into the ground, then it becomes part of the groundwater. If it does not go into the ground or evaporate, it runs off. And where does it run? It runs into the nearest creek or part of the Rouge River. Or, in the Rouge River watershed, we are heavily paved with rooftops, streets, highways, sidewalks, driveways, parking lots, large buildings like shopping centers and the like.
So not a whole lot of area for water to go.
Correct.
To soak in.
Not much area for it to soak in. And so instead, it runs into the sewers. And then from there, it can run into the river.
And why are watersheds important to our community?
Well, they're important because we've got to learn how to behave properly in a watershed so that we don't destroy the water that goes downstream from us. As you mentioned, the Rouge River empties into the Detroit River, which goes downstream then to Toledo and Cleveland and all the way out to over Niagara Falls, and it goes in into Lake Ontario and into the Atlantic Ocean. We have an impact that way.
Now, do watersheds consist of a lot of wildlife?
It consists of a wildlife wherever we have a preserve, or, well, also we're getting wildlife in our cities now. We have deer in our populated areas right here in Dearborn. We have an overabundance of deer in our natural area, and they're changing the vegetation. We have coyotes, we have mink, we have muskrat, we have wild turkeys in our area now, and those sorts of wildlife. They're also very, very important for the natural areas that we have in a watershed for migrating birds, which are happening right now as we speak. We probably had a flight of birds come to the campus here at Henry Ford and U of M Dearborn last night, because they take a night flight typically, and then they come in here and they feed, and they got to build up their fat supply so that they can move on further north to sometimes above the Arctic Circle, where they
will
be nesting, breeding, raising their young, and then come back this way.
So this is a stop for them, like a layover.
We call it a stopover.
A stopover.
Exactly what it is. And that's what we're studying here in the natural area. We're really asking, do the birds like us? How long do they stay? And we measure that by putting a little band on their leg after we capture them in a very soft net into which they fly. And then we can recapture them and see if they stay here one day, 8 days, 5 days, whatever. If they stick around for some time, and we can weigh them, and so if they gain weight, we know they like us. And that means that these natural areas in a watershed are very, very important, particularly the ones in an urban area where we just have a great deal of concrete, a great deal of impervious surface, very little vegetation. And so what we have in a natural area are an abundance of very tall canopy trees, which some exciting things are happening now that nobody knows about, in that the insects are hatching in these trees. The eggs were laid last year.
Okay.
The insects are hatching into little larvae and little nymphs that suck juices from plants. The migrating birds come along, and they feed on these larvae and nymphs, and they can get their protein.
Oh.
From which they also build up a fat supply, and they can sometimes increase their weight by 50% by feeding so that they've got enough energy to fly further north on the next night flight. And so basically what a bird sees here when they're flying over is one huge salad bar, okay, with protein mixed in with it somewhere. And that's what they're doing right now. They're just picking and pecking around in the tops of these native species of trees that we have.
Oh, very good. But it hasn't always been like that. The Rouge River and the watershed has had some issues.
Oh, very much so. And the way going way back with the issues is that this was a forested wetland, and so we had trees covering the area, and they were it was a forest at one time.
Mm-hmm.
In former times, people would travel from Detroit to Dearborn. It would take a full day travel. And they'd end up out here on Michigan Avenue in Southfield at the Tanaic Tavern. And they'd be traveling over a stagecoach road that was built on logs laid perpendicular to the line of travel. And they'd bump their way along for a full day until they got to the Tanaic Tavern. And then they would take rest. And then they'd go on their way to Ann Arbor, Chicago, or wherever. But we've drained the land. And we've taken the forest down for the most part. We've gotten rid of the trees. And now we have what we have here. And so this has made the water runoff from the land much more rapidly. And there's a big issue with the Rouge River. We call it a flashy river because you'll notice when it rains, Hines Drive closes very quickly.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's okay because
much
it's built on a flood
plain. Much to the chagrin of the travelers, commuters.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we think we own the floodplain.
Right.
Well, the river there was there first, and it owns the floodplain.
It's
there's
in
no
charge.
Question about it.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And so it would not flood nearly as much if we didn't have so much pavement, or what we call impervious surface. And then the water would come off the land much more slowly. If we had more trees and vegetation, we could reduce the runoff from the rainfall by sometimes 40%. The trees would absorb 40% of the water, and that much of the rainfall would never even hit the ground.
Wow.
And so that prevents the water then from going into the river and having a flashy river, which means that when it rains, the river rises very, very quickly. In some places in Dearborn, it can rise 6 feet on a real extreme
wow.
rainfall. And typically, it'll rise a couple feet or maybe 4 feet. In this last a month or so, we've had some pretty serious rains in the month of April and early May. And looking at the charts for the lower Rouge River around Inkster, it went up 6 feet. So from about 2.5 feet to about 8.5 feet.
And now my understanding is that the Dearborn area of the Rouge River is kind of the collect-all up from the different tributaries.
Good term for it. Yeah, we're at the...
So it's not just the rainwater from Dearborn that's pouring in there. It's coming from all these different counties. And mm-hmm. how many counties did you...
Well,
or how many areas?
Oakland County and bits of a part of Washtenaw County.
Okay.
So it's part of Oakland, part of Washtenaw, and Wayne County.
Okay.
Okay.
And now there has been a lot over the last... Oh my gosh, at least 20 years, a lot of effort in trying to clean up the Rouge River. What happened? Because I remember my mother talking about, oh, we used to swing and swim in the Rouge River and
oh, really?
Do all these activities. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, but, you know, then it got to the point where it's like, oh, don't even touch the water.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Well, that's... a very important story because people have to get rid of their wastes. And up until the 1930s and 40s, people had outhouses or they had toilets and they would just go into a sewer and they would be pumped to the river. And then we put in a sewage system in Detroit, which is at the Jefferson and the Rouge River,
okay.
which is the largest wastewater treatment system in the world. and we collected sewage from the people there. Okay, that's fine. But when it rained, our sewers, the rainwater also went into the sewers, along with our sanitary water from our dishwasher or the dishwater and the showers and bath water and wash water and toilet water and all those things. Mm-hmm. They all were mixed together. Well, the sewers weren't big enough to hold it as we expanded, and we put more and more houses up and more shops and stores and gas stations and things like that. So what do? Let the water back up into your basement? It could do that.
Right. Well, who wants
not
that?
Not a good idea. And so instead, what we did is we put something we called outfalls into the river. And it's basically to get rid of our sewage. Well, how did that dirt, you ask, how did the river get so contaminated? Nobody sees it when you put a sewer into the river. And so it's easy to do. People don't have to change their lifestyle. They have to make no decisions about how they're going to behave differently. Everything's taken care of. If this were to be potholes in a road, people would really get upset.
Right.
And they'd have to change their behavior because they wouldn't drive down that pattern anymore or that street. So it's out of sight, out of mind. And that's basically how the river got contaminated.
And this was just accepted. Like there wasn't any environmental flags at the time about what it might do or how important the Rouge River was to the area.
That's basically it for the general population. There were a number of people that were upset by it, but it was a voice not really considered at that time. Because we were doing so well as a country, our economy was booming, and this was after the Second World War, and we were busy with the Vietnam War and all sorts of things like that. And we really didn't have much concern for the water quality in the river. We weren't doing our recreation there so much, and at that time then, you can see the results of it right here in Dearborn with a concrete channel from Michigan Avenue all the way down to the Rouge Turning Basin. The way to get to deal with the river was to straighten it and get rid of the water as fast as we possibly can. And so that was the solution 35 years ago.
And now a lot of the solutions that people are working with in different cities in these counties with watersheds, I believe they're all trying to go to the combined sewer overflow option, the CSO option.
Okay, we've got the combined sewers. That's what we put in back in the 50 some years ago.
Right,
we're
trying to do this overflow system now.
Right, overflow to the river. Now we're trying to separate the sewers when we build new construction. But at the same time, for instance, Livonia has separated their sewers. And so we have stormwater only going into the Rouge River as opposed to the sewage water, which is, you know, is good and bad as well, because when you have the stormwater, it runs off the streets.
Right.
Where you have the oil, grease, salt, pet wastes, and all that stuff that comes in after it rains and washes, and fertilizer from lawns is another big component of it. So that goes directly to the river, but that's not so great either.
Right.
So what we've got to do is to take a look at the source and say, what are we doing on the land? What are we doing in our houses? What are we doing in our parking lots and in our neighborhoods?
You're listening to 89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and this is Impact. I'm your host, Kristen, and I'm talking with Dr. Oren Gelderloos, Professor of Biology and Environmental Studies at U of M Dearborn. And we're talking about the Rouge River and watersheds, and right now we've been discussing the pollution of them. And a lot of people automatically blame industry, and that's not really the case here, as you were just starting to mention a little bit earlier. Everyone wants to blame business, but so far it's been a pretty personal thing, personal mm-hmm. pollution.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Business and industry is a very easy target because they have a great deal of, they use a great number of resources in their manufacturing processes and in the business. And the river is a very good place to dump all this stuff. And we still have businesses on the river, and they're still putting materials into the river. The only difference is they have a permit to do that.
Hmm.
And the agencies have agreed, the government has agreed that, well, you can put a certain amount in the river because the water should be able to handle that much of the materials, the waste materials you want to put in the river. So they're supposed to be regulated. But it doesn't always work that way. And that's why we have the regulators issuing violation tickets and
They go around doing samples.
Well, they can do samples, and then there will be a mistake. There's a release somewhere, and you'll see coming down the Rouge River here sometimes a whole lot of red water, and we wonder where that came from. A few years ago, there was a whole lot of black water coming from someplace, and I did some measurements on the turbidity of the water, and it was very, very dark and black, and nobody knows where it came from. I inquired about from the agencies if they could figure out where it was, and nobody could understand where it came from. So we still have pollution from industries, but it is regulated. That's the difference.
Okay.
And as I said, they're an easy target. And for the most part, they really cleaned up their act. Okay. At the same time, we've got millions of people each contributing a small amount. That's the tough part.
Right.
Okay? It's easy to go after a single source, like one big industry. You shut it down, you cut out a lot of stuff. Okay, you prevent the pollution. But how do you go after 1.5 million people and try to get them to change their behavior? That's a tough one.
And what are some of the behaviors that are going on? It's a lack of education of what they do that personally affects the Rouge River, the watershed near them, or any watershed near them. I know here in Southeast Michigan, we have, what do we have, at least 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, about 12 major watersheds here in Southeast Michigan. So it's not just the Rouge River that people need to be educated about, but what are some of the behaviors that people do that affect the pollution rate?
Well, one of the things that people do is fertilize their lawns, and they want nice green lawns. They want a monoculture. And in fact, a lawn is not much different than a sidewalk when it comes to runoff of water from a rainstorm. So a lot of the water from your lawn will go down the sewer. And if you fertilize and put pesticides on the lawn, that's going to go down the sewer also. And we've measured this in various places. And we found out very high concentrations of phosphorus, for instance.
Okay.
Well, phosphorus is what has killed Lake Erie in the past when they said Lake Erie is going to die. In the late 1960s, a colleague of mine at the university made that statement at a conference and caught everybody's attention. Well, it's phosphorus, and we've taken a lot of phosphorus out of our detergents now, so that's helped. But if we put it on the lawns and it goes down the sewers directly to the river, that's yet another problem.
And that's a major component of fertilizer.
Oh, yes, it is. Nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium are the components of a fertilizer. So that's an important part. Another thing that people do is they cut down trees. Many times over the past, people come to me and say, "Oh, that's a messy tree." Well, the tree's doing what it always does. It sheds branches and twigs and things, and you like the shade? Well, you know, this
is being
a
tree.
This is what you gotta do with it, you know? It's like going into somebody's kitchen after they had a meal and say, "This is a messy house."
Yeah.
Well, you gotta do the dishes if you're gonna eat. You just have to take care of things. So, there's the idea that if we had more trees, we could prevent more runoff from the land. But everybody has their own property, and they do what they want to do in their own property.
Mm-hmm.
Except in some communities, we have a tree ordinance that prevents that sort of thing. But there are things like taking care of your pet wastes. That seems to be a big issue in rivers. We're not sure the details entirely, but that's a good component for the bacteria that are in the waterways as well.
Which is interesting to me because I know that, you know, we have an ordinance here in the city of Dearborn that you have to pick up after your pet. You take your pet for a walk, you're supposed to pick that up. And so then what happens? You take your pet out for a walk, you let them do their thing on the grass. I guess I don't really know how close to a storm drain it would have to be, but
eventually it's going to go someplace,
right?
And the only place it can go is the water, the soil, or the air. And in this case, it goes to the soil or the water. And so there's probably, with all the pets around, it's possible that and likely that this contributes to the bacterial content of the waters as well.
Wow. And a bad bacterial count in the water really affects what's in it, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it has an odor, for one thing. And when I ride my bicycle in the morning down Hines Drive on a very quiet morning before the traffic builds up, in other words, some mornings before daylight, and the air has been quiet all night, I can detect the odor from the river, a sewage odor coming from the river, even though it's not been a big storm event.
Wow. And there's also things like washing your car.
Absolutely.
Yeah. People, I mean, what happens there?
Well, again, the materials that are on your car, the grease, the grime, the salt is a big one too that goes right directly into the river. And so it's probably best to go to a car wash that recycles its water.
I think a lot of people may not realize that car washes actually are better for the environment. I think people mm-hmm. automatically think, oh, it's a car wash, ton of water, mm-hmm. you know, ton of soap, mm-hmm. all that. But it mm-hmm. recycles the water and the soap and mm-hmm. just reuses that water instead of it rushing on off into the mm-hmm. storm drain.
Absolutely.
So education of the 1.5 million people that live in the Metro Detroit area is a huge deal.
It is. It's teaching us how to behave in the place where we live. And to behave sustainably, not just for us, not just for the plants and animals, but for future generations as well. That's really what we're working very hard on and have been doing now for decades, trying to educate people and ask people to examine their lifestyle.
Well, and it's not just, the watershed isn't just for the purpose of a natural habitat, although not that that's not good enough, but a lot of people don't realize that there's a lot of recreation involved with the watersheds that are around in the area. And I know I was at a place where their fishing couldn't happen that day mm-hmm. because of something that was going on with the water levels and the pollution level. And how does that come into play as far as environmental impact, the recreation that people do? Once again, an education responsibility?
Oh, definitely. And this has to do with quality of life. You know, why do people want to recreate or recreate? What does this have to do? Well, most of this in these days has gone indoors. And our goal these days is to get people out of doors, get the kids
outdoors,
get the kids on the streets again.
Get moving.
Yeah, but it has economic impacts, you know, for fishing, as you mentioned. But more importantly, I think it's the quality of life that one has. The way one recreates one's spirit. And, you know, we spend lots of time with yoga and things like that, but being in a natural environment has an awful lot to do with a person's attitude, with their emotional health, and their psychological state of mind. We know that from research that has been very high-quality scientific research. Connections to natural areas makes a person a different type of person. And we don't have that here. For instance, I was just talking about the concrete channel. When we first talked about putting the concrete channel in, there were a group of us that said this is not a good idea. What we should do is hold the water back and don't let it flow down a channel and get out of here quickly. Well, at that time, where they were at the end of an era, the Army Corps of Engineers said this is the way we have to do it. Mm. Okay, and because of the 1948 flood, they built this channel in 1975. Okay. Now, how many people can get to the water on the concrete channel? Nobody.
Nobody.
It's fenced off.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are we doing now? Now we're spending money to build the Gateway Trail, which started at Ford Road and goes to Michigan Avenue and ends up by Andiamo's Restaurant.
Right.
We're building, we hope, and we have plans to put this Gateway Trail all the way to the Detroit River. Well, what will it take? It'll take removing much of the concrete in the concrete channel, okay?
Uh-oh.
So our ideas in the 1960s and early 70s were to get rid of the water and run it down to the Detroit River, the concrete channel. People said, no, that wasn't a good idea. Well, obviously we're overruled. Now, what are they saying? We need a better quality of life here in Southeast Michigan, so people want to move here and have places to recreate.
Right.
And we got to get rid of the channel. The concrete and put the pathway along it, and we have to put in places where the fish can rest and feed and so on and so forth. So there's multiple issues we have to deal with rather than just a single issue of getting rid of floodwater. That was the purpose of the concrete channel, single issue mentality. Okay, we got to learn how to deal with complex issues and multiple issue, develop a multiple issue mentality.
And that is a huge aspect to a desired community for people to move into is nice recreational areas to go to. And when you have a watershed that is polluted and smells and you know, there's a big joke about, you know, you don't go fishing in the Rouge River. You might get a fish with, you know, three eyes and five fins or something, you know, which is horrible, but that's what people say, you know.
Exactly,
so
right.
Why would anybody want to move to that community? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it takes some forward thinking to recognize that fact.
Yeah. And that's what we've been working on for a long time, thanks to the leadership of people like Vice Chancellor Ed Begale at the University of Michigan Dearborn. He's been working on that by putting a coalition of people here, including Henry Ford Community College and Ford Motor Company and Ed Levy's company and Marathon Oil and Wayne County and many other people, putting them together for this Gateway Partnership.
So companies and individuals all over the place have decided, okay, this is going to make an impact on our future, and we need to do something about it.
Absolutely.
This is 89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to Impact. I'm your host, Kristen, and I am here with Dr. Oren Gelderloos, who is professor of biology and environmental studies at U of M Dearborn. We've been talking about the Rouge River and watersheds throughout southeast Michigan, why they're important, and how to help them. So moving into volunteers and the cleaning up of the Rouge River. I understand you have a big part with Friends of the Rouge, which is also located at U of M Dearborn, but Friends of the Rouge goes throughout the whole southeast Michigan area of the river.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do?
This is a citizens and a grassroots not-for-profit volunteer organization. They have a number of staff people working in there, and it's funded by grant money. And so they do not make a profit by providing services for people and charging for those services. They're basically an advisory organization for community people on how to best preserve the river. And they do a number of things. One is they have a school education program. And that's basically where it started about just about 25 years ago now. And I've been involved with it since its inception, so I have a pretty good feeling of what's been happening over time. But the school education program is one in which teachers in schools work with the students on how to do water quality analysis. And then they test for the amount of oxygen in the river. They test for how turbid the river is, how muddy it is. They can test for the amount of nitrogen, the acidity or alkalinity, or the pH of the river. And they learn how to do this in the classroom, and they learn what a watershed is. And then on one day in May, all the schools will go out to different sites on the Rouge River and perform these tests. And they take the data from those tests, and they put them all together, and they get a bigger picture of what the Rouge River looks like in terms of the water quality. That's one of the programs that the Friends of the Rouge has done since its inception. And they started out with 16 schools, and then they've gone to 80-some, and they have thousands of students involved in this project. They also are involved in public education and public information and providing services to people and their communities. One of the big areas that they need to deal with is, what do people who live along the river do to their property? In other words, do they mow the property and make grass out of it right down to the river and fertilize and treat it like a lawn? Or can they make a buffer between the river and their house and their property and increase the diversity of organisms that live there by putting in native plants and animals?
Okay.
That's an important part. And there's a third part that they do, and that is to provide native species rain gardens. The idea is to keep the water from going into the sewer by planting a rain garden, meaning that it's a garden where the rain comes from your roof and your downspouts, and it goes into a holding area on your own property.
Hmm.
At the University of Michigan Dearborn, we have several rain gardens now around the Interpretive Center, and we have collected thousands and thousands of gallons of water. In fact, just from a three-day rain that we had a few years ago, we collected about 13,000 gallons of water.
Wow.
Just from one of those one rainfall, and that keeps it from going into the river. Now, just think if you had all of the households here in Southeast Michigan develop some sort of a rain garden, so that when the downspout put the water out into the yard, that it would stay in some sort of a holding area. And this is catching on. The other point is that they should use native plants, plants that are native to Southeast Michigan,
right,
as opposed to plants that are imported from like Colorado spruce or Norway maples and things like that, because those plants are well suited to withstand some of the pests that we have here and some of the stresses that are put on plants throughout the year, the winter stresses and so on and so forth.
Right. Now, you're talking to somebody, though, who has a black thumb. I try to grow different things on my property, and I just, for lack of a better word, I kill just about anything I touch. And so how hardy are these rain gardens? You know, hostas are about the only thing I've been able to work with. So how hardy are these? What type of plants, you know, or is it more like perennials versus annuals? And
okay. My wife made two rain gardens in our backyard, and she dug a depression so that when the downspout came, carried the water out, it went into a depression, and it was held there for a while, and since we've got quite a bit of sand on our property, it just percolates down into the sand very quickly.
Huh.
And she lined it with river rock and put some flagstone around the outside of it, and it looks very aesthetically pleasing. And so we don't worry about the plants in this particular rain garden. You don't have to worry about that.
Okay.
She just plants plants around the outside of it, and hostas are there, and they work perfectly fine. I know they're not native species here.
Hostas are great, though. I can just chop those things in half and spread them out, and they're just, oh, hello.
Yeah, right. And there's hostas, I used to think were old houses plants, but they're coming back, and they made a revival because they're doing quite well in our urban areas. So that's just fine. But the point is that you try to keep the water on site somehow to keep it from going into the sewer and down into the river and adding to everybody else's water that comes off their land into the sewer as well, and making the river flashy.
So Friends of the Rouge can actually help people.
Oh, yeah.
With the rain garden, and so can the U of M Environmental Interpretive Center. They they have lots of people for advice and helping, and I believe some of them actually will come out to your property too.
Yes, that's correct. They will try to help. They have limited funding and for limited staff, and so they try to work with people in groups. For instance, Dearborn Heights, but the mayor of Dearborn Heights put on a program along with the Watershed Commission of Dearborn Heights on rain gardens, and a lot of people showed up to that. Friends of the Rouge puts on programs in the Interpretive Center. And so we collaborate. They have the staff and we have the facility on our campus that they can use for educational purposes. And we use our rain garden as a model. And I'd encourage people to stop out and have a look and see what goes into a rain garden. I would also point out that people say, oh, I don't have to have a lawn to mow anymore. I can just sit back and drink my iced tea. Well,
why not?
That isn't the way it works. A garden still has to be cared for. You have to still take out plants that want to go in there because they are tougher than the plants you plant.
Kind of like the mustard seed issue.
There you go.
That the Rouge Watershed has been having in
that's
this area
right.
That was brought in. That's just pretty much taken over, which I know Friends of the Rouge is really trying hard. I mean, they're down on their hands and knees pulling this stuff out to keep it from spreading.
That's right. And that's what Rescue the Rouge is about. And let me just point out now then that on June 5 is going to be the River Rescue Day. It's on the first Saturday of June every year. And Friends of the Rouge, again, has sites all over the Rouge River watershed. And every community, or many communities, I should say, have a coordinator. And they have enlist volunteers to work on certain sites in the river.
Yeah, I picked up a flyer on that, and there's like 38. I had a flyer. There's like 38 different sites.
You are
throughout
correct.
That you can go to. Oh, it's right in front of me, right there. So it's not just here in Dearborn. They're wow, they're all over the place, anywhere the Rouge hits, basically.
Right.
What are some of the activities that happen during the Rouge Rescue? What can people expect if they want to volunteer?
Yeah, that's a good point. On the 15th of May, the city of Inkster had their Rouge Rescue. They adjusted it for various reasons. And a group of volunteers from my church went out and assisted them, so I have some firsthand experience there. We helped on a trail along the river so that people could have better access to the river and see it and understand more about it. Well, in doing that, we had to maintain the trail, put wood chips down, had to clear out some of the honeysuckle, which is an invasive species and takes over the place and crowds out the native species, and then they removed some of the trash that was there, lots of tires that people rolled over the hill and things like that. And we pulled garlic mustard. And we pulled garlic mustard, and we pulled garlic mustard.
and we pulled garlic mustard over and over and over.
Right. And it's important there, of course, to take care of it, because you got to put it in a plastic bag and haul it away so that the seeds of it don't, even if you pull it out, the seeds will come back next year and germinate, of all things. It's tough.
And how did that get introduced into the watershed? How did that?
Oh, it came along with all the other weeds that we have and plants, like dandelions and plantain and the buckthorn trees. It came from our counterparts in Europe when they brought over their household goods and they brought over their cattle and just the way the Dutch elm disease got brought in here on logs, lumber, and all the other invasive species that we have. It just happened. And when I first came here in 1969 and 70, I was delighted to find garlic mustard. I thought, look at this. There's one tiny patch in the woods down behind Henry Ford Community College. I had to go down to the river to fetch it and show my students what garlic mustard was. And now I...
Fetching your students to get rid of it.
Yeah, you fall over it when you walk outdoors these days. So just in those about 20 years or so, it spread into the shady wooded areas on our campus.
And that hurts the ecosystem.
Yeah, it takes over from all of the other spring wildflowers that we have. It crowds them out. And we, in our forest here, we have such a beautiful collection of spring wildflowers and great diversity that it's a shame to see them disappear.
So at this Rouge River Rescue, which is, we'll mention again here, this coming Saturday, June 5th, no, I'm sorry, after Memorial Weekend,
right.
two weekends from now on June 5th. So they could expect to pull mustard seed.
Garlic mustard.
Garlic mustard, yeah, garlic mustard seed. And what else?
Some communities have a project in which they build various things. They might be building a little bridge, or they might be getting rid of trash. That's a common thing they can do. They may be planting native species gardens as well. The community can prepare the soil and put in and shape the land and landscape it to the right elevations and everything, and then they can do a lot of planting of the plants that Friends of the Rouge has been able to spend money to purchase on through the grants that they get as well.
Okay.
So those are some of the things. It's mostly cleanup and things I think people can do in a few hours. The idea is that it'll stimulate people to get involved more in long-term projects, like in monitoring things that go on in their neighborhood, like in the Rouge Park area. It's very, very important there, I think, to have neighborhood monitors to look at what's going on in the park and the quality of life so people don't trash it and destroy it and behave improperly in the parks there. Another activity that we hope they will get involved with is the frog and toad survey.
I was going to ask you about that.
Okay. Frogs and toads are a very good indicator of the quality of the environment.
And why is that?
Well, because they're sensitive. They're sensitive to changes in the environment and quality. They need clean water. And if you can measure where the frogs and the toads are, that's a pretty good idea of the quality of the water and the quality of the ponds that are there. It's not just the river water that they're in, but it's all little ponds and lakes and
everything that stems from it and
around it. And so if we can show some a spread of the frogs and toads throughout the watershed and increase the area in which we find them, it means that the water quality is improving. And so in the springtime, then volunteers go out and they listen in the evening to the calls and the vocalizations of frogs and toads. And you have to learn the calls of the different
species. I was just going to ask what kind of training is involved for that. Well, I would be sitting there going, what was that? What was that?
Well, you have an audio a tape or a disc, and you can listen on your iPod or whatever and just listen to the sounds and learn them. And they're very distinctive. Everyone is so distinctive. It's not possible to confuse them. Okay? And so it's just so nice to be able to now, in the last couple of years, to drive down Hines Drive on my bicycle, and I hear the chorus frogs singing in a little puddle by the Parkland picnic area. It's a place, a pond of water, which is not much bigger than our studio. And here are these small frogs singing away, looking for a mate, with their calls that they produce. They were doing that in April.
So they do it in April? And May, and then...
And the bullfrogs are starting now.
Okay.
Typically, June is bullfrog month, but yesterday morning I heard bullfrogs again on our lake on the campus.
So then spring is a huge time for the frog and toad survey.
Yeah, that's the mating season. Okay? Yeah.
Now, is this an activity that families can participate in, or is it strictly more adults? Like, do you allow children to participate in this type of thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're supervised by an adult.
Right,
but children
right.
can come along and learn the calls very quickly, too.
And, it just seems like that would be something fun for a family to be able to do, you know, help the Rouge River, help the environment, and, you know, have a nice, fun family outing as well in the evening.
It's a great activity. Yeah, it's a great activity.
What other activities do Friends of the Rouge do?
Okay, Friends of the Rouge also put on what they call a winter stonefly search or a winter bug hunt. They go out in January, and they examine what's living in the river. Now, I know it's snowy and it can be cold, but with waders and hip boots and nets, they can search the bottom of the river in a variety of locations throughout the watershed and use the organisms that are in the river. We call them benthic macroinvertebrates that live in the bottom of the stream now and see what's there. And if the water's bad, they're not going to be there. If some chemical or some pollutant came down the river at some time or other, they're going to kill them off.
Just wipes them out.
And we won't find them then. And so they're kind of a long-term monitoring device for us to have these organisms there. And then in the spring, they have another bug hunt that they go out, and they look for organisms in the river then. And these are family activities too, by the way.
Okay.
And they'll get more than 100 people involved in some of these on a Saturday morning, for instance.
Wow.
And they bring the data back, they bring the insects and the invertebrates back, and they have specialists that come and help them to identify them to make sure that the data are accurate.
Now, just recently I remember reading about a particular insect that was found that was kind of like a needle in a haystack, and it was a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it called? The stone?
A stonefly.
Stonefly.
Yeah.
Stonefly. Why was that such a big deal?
Because they're very sensitive insects. They have to have higher quality of water to live than some other organisms. There are many organisms that, you know, will live in sewage-filled water. They thrive in that, but that's only a few. But there are the stoneflies that require a higher quality water.
So that was a really good thing. That was an exciting thing.
That's
it showed
good
the efforts efforts of the communities and Friends of the Rouge and all the volunteers that it's working.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's encouraging to say, well, let's keep working at this, okay? Let's not give up on it and move to some other place and abandon Southeast Michigan. Let's not do that.
Which would be the easy route.
Oh,
that
absolutely.
That would be the easy way out.
Yeah, that's what has happened in many places.
So I was reading, real quickly here. You're listening to 89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to Impact, a public affairs talk program. And I am Kristen, and I'm talking with Dr. Oren Gelderloos, who is professor of biology and environmental studies at U of M Dearborn, as well as a major activist in the nonprofit organization Friends of the Rouge. And we've been talking about Friends of the Rouge and what they do for the community. And just going back briefly here to the Rouge Rescue that's going to be happening on Saturday, June 5th, I was reading in the Rouge Rescue report that I have here that 2009 was a huge success and over 2,200 volunteers joined forces for Rescue the Rouge. That's incredible.
Yes, it is. And I think it tells that people really care. There are a lot of people that say, look, we want to make a difference in our community. and that's just a great thing to be a part of.
And what also really surprised me, sorry to admit, but I've never participated in one in the past, but I plan on participating in this one.
Good.
Volunteers removed 76 cubic feet and 710 bags of trash out of the river and the surrounding areas. That just seems massive.
It is.
A ton of, I would just think that it would be getting better. Tell me this is better. That's what I want to know. That this, that 2009 at 710 bags of trash, including, says tires, construction debris, furniture, appliances, bicycles, and four cars. This is better, right?
This is better. That's correct. And just keep in mind that this is from various locations around the watershed, not from the all the miles, not all the 126 miles of waterway that are there.
Right. These are just from the 38.
Yeah, these are just
the 38
from
locations
those sites. Yeah.
Here.
So it's like taking a sample, sort of like taking a biopsy of one place, but not every place. And so there's a lot of work to be done. But most importantly, it would be really, really wonderful if we did not have to have a Rouge Rescue Day in the future.
Yes.
So that we would not have any trash in the river, that the water quality would be to the point that you could have bodily contact with the water. That should be our goal.
Go back to swimming in the Rouge River without having to worry about becoming contaminated.
Right. Or at least having some sort of a contact with the river. For many years, we've tried to have a triathlon in the Middle Rouge and have the swimming part of it up in Newburgh Lake. But the health department said it would not be safe.
Wow.
It would be nice if that would happen someday.
And there's so many times when Lake St. Clair is closed, is closed off. All swimming is closed off from that due to high contamination.
That's correct.
But since you've been involved with Friends of the Rouge for the last 25 years since its inception, you've seen improvement.
Yeah, it is changing, but it's slowly because it was it deteriorated very, very slowly as well. You know, inch by inch by inch, we decided to put the combined sewer overflows into the river some years ago, and it was okay until that point. And people said, well, you know, we don't want to spend extra money taking care of our sewage and processing it so that it's all pure before it goes into the Detroit River. We don't want it to back up in our basement. Okay, for a few times a year, we'll send it out to the Detroit River. Well, a few times a year became many times a year. And in some cases, it became continuous dumping of the sewage into the river. So things, you know, happened slowly. And we got into this mess very slowly and gradually, and now it's going to take time to get us out. But I think the important thing is that all these people that come on this Rouge Rescue can be made aware of more things that they can do. And I think this is wonderful. Like there was at the, as I mentioned, the rescue event that they had in the city of Inkster, got over 100 people there together.
Wow.
And listened to what they had to say and what they're going to do, and they're involved. It's just wonderful to have these people involved. And now, when more information comes about, you know, of things that they can do, like disconnect or downspout, that's wonderful. If you really want to help the river, plant trees.
Right.
Okay, that will make a big difference. In addition to paying for these big concrete caissons that are going in the ground, and underground tunnels and storage tanks and all things like that. So there's, you know, if you're building a new building, have the city put a green roof on the top of the building, like they did at the Ford Rouge plant. And also, if you're going to put in a parking lot for automobiles, make the surface of it porous so the water goes through the parking lot surface into the ground rather than running off.
So that's an option.
It is.
See, I don't think a lot of people even realize
that. No, they don't. And this is where involvement in our city and municipal life has to take place. You know, keeping the people, the commissioners, and the managers of cities aware of what's going on and try to take leadership in these areas as opposed to just following the traditional path. And so citizens can get involved in that. And that's why, for instance, the Watershed Commission of Dearborn Heights is so important. It's a small community, of course, but these are dedicated people. And the League of Women Voters is a wonderful organization. They're one of my heroes for the work that they've been doing. It's a small group, but they are very persistent.
Yes, they are.
And they persevere, and I admire them very, very much.
Is there anything else that we haven't broached here about Watersheds or Friends of the Rouge, Interpretive Center, that you might like to discuss before we end the show?
Sure. I can just say that it would be wonderful to have people join Friends of the Rouge, to get on the mailing list, the email list, I should say, for the Interpretive Center. Go to the website for the university, look up Environmental Interpretive Center, and get on their email so that you are able to access the newsletter. Also recognize that Friends of the Rouge has recreational activities on the Rouge River.
I noticed that. I picked up another flyer here about a canoe trip and a kayak trip that are happening in the fall.
Very good. Yeah, good for you. Yeah. We initiated a kayak trip a number of years ago, and on the last Saturday in September, and it starts in Melvindale and goes down to the Detroit River. And it's good to have some aquatic experience, some water experience before you get in a kayak for the first time. And so we encourage people to take their own kayak if they wish, and they can rent a kayak from a Riverside Kayak. And it's a wonderful trip. I made up a little triptych for it as well, in which you can stick on underneath your bungee cord on the front of your kayak and just turn the pages as we go down the river and go by the Rouge plant, and you can see it from an entirely different perspective. You can see what people are doing along the concrete channel, how the plants are kind of taking over. You can see the different industries that are on the river that nobody can understand or knows that are there. It's just not on anybody else's radar, but the U.S. Gypsum Company and the world's largest wastewater treatment plant and Zug Island and the DTE Energy plant with the three stacks where they use coal and natural gas and all things like that.
And you just kayak on past
yeah,
it
yeah,
with your about, with your little guide.
That's right.
book guide that you
yep.
have. And
mm-hmm.
that's awesome.
And then the canoe trip starts in the lower Rouge River up by Wayne. And they can go down the river that way, and they provide the canoes for you at that time. So, that's another wonderful thing. We're trying to bring recreation back to the Rouge, and those are a couple of events that are very, very good to do.
Well, now you also do tours, don't you? Fan tours?
Yes. I lead bus tours for Friends of the Rouge around the area from time to time, as they wish, or any other groups, too. I've taken church groups, I've taken civic groups, and that sort of a thing on a tour of Southeast Michigan and the Rouge River watershed. Sometimes we've gone with public officials up the Middle Rouge River to Novi and Walled Lake and places like that. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time and coming in here. And just briefly, when we were talking before this, you were talking about something else that you do besides teach at the University of Michigan. You also have activities in India.
Yes, I teach a course on the ecology of the Indian tropics during the winter break on campus. Right after Christmas, we leave for a three-week course, and I have students from various colleges around the United States, and we meet with students from South India, so it's a great cross-cultural experience, and I have faculty from South India that really can head the program up there. And we study the ecological systems from the Bay of Bengal and the mangrove ecosystems to the plains and the impoundments and the bird life there, as well as in the Western Ghat Mountains, where the Indira Gandhi National Wildlife Refuge is located, where we have the charismatic mega mammals like elephants and many, and the tigers are there as well.
Wow.
And although we don't see them, we're more interested in being in the habitat where the tigers are and understanding the habitat and the elephants, as I mentioned, and several species of primates and endangered species are there as well. So it's a program that no other people are able to get.
Well, that's incredible. And all that information can be found on U of M Dearborn's website?
That would be involved. That's taught through the Ausable Institute of Environmental Studies.
Ah. Okay.
But if they want to contact me at the university, I'm on Facebook, I'm on internet there. I'm happy to talk with anybody about it.
Well, great. And they would just look on Facebook for Gelderloos?
That's right.
And
it was my first name. There are several Gelderlooses on Facebook.
Okay, so Dr. Oren Gelderloos. and look for the U of M Dearborn information,
right,
too, as well,
sure,
on there. And for further information about the Rouge Rescue of 2010 on Saturday, June 5th, you can go to therouge.org. That's the, T-H-E, Rouge, R-O-U-G-E, .org for more information about that. Well, once again, Dr. Gelderloos, thank you so much for coming in to talk with me here on Impact. And it's so nice to know that U of M Interpretive Center and the Friends of the Rouge are definitely making an impact on the environment and our watershed that is so close to home. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
You have been listening to Impact here on 89.3 WHFR.FM. Please join me, Kristen, next time on June 22nd, the fourth Tuesday of the month, from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m., to see what is coming up next here on Impact. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
WHFR Dearborn. 89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to One Chord to Another, where every Tuesday for 2 hours from 2 to 4 p.m., I, your host, Jeff, play some of the best new and slightly used indie rock and pop in the world. Thank you so much for hanging out with me this afternoon. And if you're hanging out with me, why not give me a call and make a request? I'd love to hear from you. I can be reached here directly in the WHFR studios by calling 313-845-9676. And that's option one. Again, that number to call in and make your requests and be a part of the show is 313-845-9676, option one for the studio. Got lots of great music on the show today. Music from Hot Chip, there's music from Joel Plaskett, and so much more. You're not going to want to go anywhere. Starting things off on the show today is a band that has a new record coming out near the end of next month called The Five Ghosts. I'm talking, of course, about the Canadian band Stars. While we're patiently waiting for their new record, here they are now with music off of their last record entitled In Our Bedroom After the War. This is Take Me to the Riots on the station making waves for 25 years, 89.3 WHFR.FM.
Gray skies and light fading, headlamps making patterns on the wall. Uptown is dead now, but out here no one seems to care at all. Sick girls and sick boys.